Joe, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, Tim. How are you?
Very well. Today, we're going to dedicate the show to the royal wedding. the storybook wedding.
Okay, since we're going to do that, let's just talk about the great Satan.
Okay.
So that we can like link the what we're discussing with the Masonic, satanic event witnessed around the world.
Yeah, the storybook wedding of a 36-year-old bride divorced. Yeah. I'm trying to figure this out. But anyway.
I mean, I don't know. I just think they should have been wearing horns. You know, it would have kind of just set off the whole festivity properly.
Well, okay. Well, anyway. the Great Satan. That's an interesting term. The Great Satan... is kind of a derogatory term, I guess, for the United States that was introduced by... Senate actually refers to the United Kingdom, by the way, too. But it was introduced by Ayatollah Khomeini in November 1979 to describe the United States, which he accused of imperialism and sponsoring corruption throughout the world. I think this was... Yeah, this was during the hostage crisis. So, what about that accusation, the Great Satan? I mean, often it's been picked up, and I think it's an interesting concept because, I imagine I would probably have a lot of disagreements with the late Ayatollah Khomeini about a number of things. Generally speaking, he wasn't too off track, right?
No, I mean, he got it right. I think he could have been a little clearer in his use of the expression, but the Ayatollah... was not the Ayatollah of rock and roll. He was a more fundamental kind of guy. And I think he was actually in his description, he was talking about Iblis, and I know I'm butchering the word, so people can speak Arabic, please don't send me, criticisms. I'm just doing the best I can here. In Islam, you have a great demon, basically the equivalent of Satan. Mm-hmm. But he's kind of an equivalent of the Satan that comes from Christianity or Christianity. But he is very well known for deception. He deceives, right? He fools. And I think that Khomeini was talking about the way that the Shah, the Pahlavi family, had been inserted by the West in Iran, and that the whole process to remove the democratically elected, and it's another name, the Mozaa Bek, who had been democratically elected but wouldn't play ball with BP oil, and so they basically created a coup. The coup was what I think Khomeini was referring to, and everything subsequent that basically the narrative that was given the Iranians by the Shah in the West was fake, and that I think Khomeini was kind of linking it in a religious context into the seduction of Muslims by infidels. These are themes inside the Quran. So I think when Khomeini used the expression, it was kind of technical. I haven't been able really to get any kind of Arabic sort of interpretations of Khomeini's use of the expression, but I'm pretty sure I'm right that the West, you know, kind of, I don't know, they poo-pooed it, but it's interesting. It really never went away, Tim. The concept of the Great Satan and of America being satanic, because this, I think, is words and concepts morph as they move through time, as they interact with reality. They sometimes take on meanings that are existential, you know, that weren't when it was originally, the term was not originally used. And so the Great Satan, America as the Great Satan, I've seen the expression used in the last few years in relation to America as a satanic, area. An area where Satan and Satanism are prevalent, that I think is interesting, because I think that the people that are using that expression are kind of not so much connecting with Khomeini's idea of, you know, the Iblis deceiver, but are actually talking more about the moral structure of our leaders and of the secret society. Mm-hmm. So when you hear the expression, you know, the Great Satan, what do you think? How do you understand the expression?
Well, I understand, again, sort of America exporting its corrupt culture, corporate globalism, sort of this idea of, or this the right or the mission to undermine traditional societies in order to bring it into the fold, into the Western corporatist fold, and that's carried out, whether it's through the intelligence agencies like CIA, or literally through the NGOs, which is like National Endowment for Democracy, or even various churches and missionaries and these things, and traditionally, what's happened in the West is a lot of these. That the established churches have been infiltrated by the intelligence agencies and the interests that control them to spread sort of Western globalism, this corporate monoculture, and using things like human rights and democracy, these weaponized ideas now, there's an excuse to go in and sort of bring enlightenment to a benighted world. And many Americans have internalized this because that's how they view their history of, as America as the savior, going to war twice in Europe to save Europe from Prussian militarism,
from genocide. Yeah, we did a great job there.
Yeah, these things. So, and in order to justify not just the sacrifice, but just the violence that America has perpetrated throughout the world, more or less pick up this narrative of America as the liberating nation, the Enlightenment nation. And it's interesting because you hear terms like Great Satan and these things, and then America enlightening the world, and you think of Enlightenment, and you think of Luciferianism. And I immediately thought of just going back to, we can talk about it later, about the crimes of the American state that's been done in the name of spreading freedom, manifest destiny, democracy, these things. You immediately think of sort of America's Freemasonic origins, and sure. How a lot of if you look at a lot of justification for American intervention abroad, it has it's very close to a lot of these ideas of Freemasonry, pluralism, ecumenism, these things. Yeah. Things that would undermine a traditional society, like Spain or Portugal, or even Italy or Europe in general, these things. And so these things, Americans have internalized these ideas as ideas of liberty in these things. But really, America, particularly in the 20th century, has been a force for international instability abroad. And the primary source of instability has been the United States and really their cousins in London, the Anglo-American order, and of course that this gave birth to Zionism, which is a product of the Anglo-American alliance.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, we can just end the show. I mean, it's exactly right.
Good night.
Yeah. You know, I couldn't agree more. The thing is, I look at the America as the Satan. Actually, America was a continuation of the satanic foreign policy of the British. I think what you had historically was a process by which Freemasonry basically gained enough political control and enough technologic power to really go after world domination. And I think that this really was in the 1840s and 50s. And I think that, like, you can again trace this back to Palmerston.
Yeah, steam power and the telegraph.
Yeah, and you know, and trains, you have the expression used by one of the heads of a nation in Europe in a letter to Palmerston, and he referred to all of the agents that were running through Europe and actually the Middle East to create unrest and revolution. And he referred to them as Palmerston's zoo, right? That was an expression that was then picked up by LaRouche scholars when they were looking at the Masonic sort of control of America. Then they were looking backwards to what was going on in Britain that led up to America's corrupt foreign policy. And, you know, you could see that it was just one process. After World War II, with Europe basically in rubble, the Masonic power was transferred to the United States, right? That's pretty much, I mean, it took perhaps, say, from the beginning of the you know, the 20th century right up to, say, like 1960 to conclude all this. But in that period, Britain, which had been, you know, the dominant political force and economic force, basically collapsed under the effect of the two world wars, and the pound collapsed, and now the dollar was, you know, going to get used in foreign trade, and America was going to have a world cop dictatorship military, because there was the resources there that could be exploited. But the fact is that you had this process completely without any real contradictions. In other words, there wasn't a moment where the U.S. sort of stopped the porn policy, the process that the British had created. The British had developed the British Masonic control, right? So it develops the political structure of that's going to lead to the two world wars. You've got all of these individuals, agents running rampant through Europe. Manzini, Bakunin, you know, the Russian Revolution. These things are all coming from the same Masonic cesspool that's primarily operating in England. But it's throughout Europe, and so this then is the beginning of the satanic, you know, kind of control over the world. It was when the Masons got enough technical control to both, you know, for example, like Palmerston used, you know, Gatling guns and mechanical cannons to, you know, blow up the Chinese and make sure that they would continue to eat opium. They were able to put troops into Ireland to genocide the Irish people. You know, they had the peasants didn't have the weapons to fight back. And so they used their, this was the first sort of satanic moment in the world where, well, in our that led up to our modern world, where you had the Masons with enough political and technical power. And then, you know, you went forward into World War II and you transferred everything to the United States. But I was just, don't want to be long-winded, sorry. But the one thing, a point I was trying to make is that's why it's really important to realize that the term Satanism had really kind of fallen away in the United States. I mean, you know, there wasn't, much use of the term. If you go through magazines and things between the beginning of the 19th century and up to like 1980, there just really wasn't that much interest in it. But what had happened was Satan was making a comeback, Tim, because the Quattro Coronati, which, of course, as we know, created both Zionism, certainly was the prime mover for Zionism, and also can be shown to have promoted and led directly to, you know, the Nazi Party, right? They created the dialectic, which is going to end up with moving, you know, the Jews into Israel and getting rid of the Europeans. They were also creating the occult. I mean, just as an example, astrology had almost completely disappeared, but these guys brought it back. A little known fact, I was amazed by this. I found this in one of Anton Klivitz's lectures and looked it up. And sure enough, the very group that had, you know, was going to give us the joys of Zionism and the Nazi Party had also brought back astrology. Okay, my point is that when they set Helen Blavatsky in motion, the Theosophical Society, hopefully I'm pronouncing it correctly, that this leads directly into the Thule Society and then to the Nazis, very, very straight line. All of the concepts are completely in alignment. This is a trajectory. It's, I think, just ironclad. When they did that, they also... They didn't just give Blavatsky's kind of ISIS occultism, you know, satanic, you know, kind of mysticism as a cover for what they were trying to do. They also gave us Aleister Crowley. And this is the point, is that here you have just out and out Satanism as a kind of a like a philosophy, right? That is also going to be creeping into our culture. You know, he is, you know, has relationships into the same people as Blavatsky. And specifically, Tim, if you look at Quattro Coronati, and I hope this isn't going to, you know, take our audience into like all these terms and expressions, but you have John Yager creating the occultism of Memphis and Mizraim. And again, I'm not in my head. I don't have the pronunciation of the last term. I could be misspeaking it, but it's clear enough. And so this was this really weird ISIS, quasi satanic kind of mysticism that was going to be off and on used by both Blavatsky and Crowley, who knew each other. And of course, they were both being set into motion and working with Quattro Coronati, with John Yager. So when we say America is satanic, you have to look at what you referred to as Aleister Crowley's long shadow. You use that expression about Crowley and a couple shows ago, and it stuck with me, that everyone calls him a crackpot. You know, his rock and roll idols have pictures of him. You know, the Beatles have him on the cover of Sgt. Pepper. And, you know, the Led Zeppelin is their followers. Tim Leary loves the guy. I mean, just everyone. But there really isn't. Why are they so influenced by this guy, right? Well, for one thing, it's because he's bringing about this cult of Satan. Right? He refers to himself as the great beast. You know, you see pictures of him. Horns on, right? He has a sex magic, which is obviously, you know, can relate to Satanism. So my point is that when you look at America's foreign policy, it really is satanic. This isn't like, you know, we're not like, you know, like metaphors here. I mean, this is really, I think, a very good explanation as to what is the philosophy that is driving the thing. It's coming right from the group that is in charge of our foreign, the secret society, which we don't understand or know about or told about. They manipulate this facade of democracy, but they have control over the leader, so they can control the foreign policy. The public is in the dark. We just see the wars and the body count. But why is there so much slaughter and genocide? Well, it's because it's coming from a group that basically has, you know, a satanic, you know, philosophy. And then, you know, we recently had the WikiLeaks and the Pizzagate business. And in one of the leaks, a person is sending an email to John Podesta and she wants to see Obama, and she has a good relationship with Podesta, and she says, please grant me this Thelema favor, right? This is right in the document. Thelema is Aleister Crowley's cult.
Mm-hmm.
I won't go into it, but it's basically, by any rational use of the term, it's a satanic cult. And so this is a language, a term, you know, Thelema, that the ordinary public wouldn't know what it means. And yet this person can use it without any description of the word and expect that Podesta would just understand it and then grant her access to Barack Obama. So I would say that's a pretty good indicator that, the Satanists are in control. And so when we call America the Great Satan, yeah, we are.
That's interesting, because you think of someone like Podesta, who's a political operative involved in realpolitik, hard knuckleball politics and these things, to be involved in sort of something so esoteric and satanic and strange. But nevertheless, if you really get to Aleister Crowley's offering, a world where the powerful can do what thou wilt, then you can see how someone who is a practitioner of realpolitik would be a Satanist, because then he's not inhibited by morality.
Sure.
So it's not as strange as it might seem. That's why a lot of Aleister Crowley was also involved in British intelligence and gathering information for British intelligence, because they're involved in empire, and he'd be aware of some of these esoteric practices from the East that anthropologists, the type of people that empires employ to expand and maintain their empires and these things. Same with the intelligence agencies. You have figures like Colonel Michael Aquino, who is a psychological warfare specialist involved in Vietnam, probably with the Phoenix operation. He's an avowed Satanist. And he also happens to be, one time was the head chaplain for the Pentagon, which tells you something about that department.
That's a clue.
It's not a strange thing. But if you look at American foreign policy of saturation, bombing, drone attacks, firing missiles here and there just so you can get rid of your inventory, these things is purely satanic. I ran across an article before we get in, because maybe we want to provide a little gram here when you say that foreign policy is satanic. We'll get into the list of horribles that is the American foreign policy of the past century. But
Tim, you do me a favor and just give us the list that if you have it, because I think it's an important thing for people to actually, digest.
Well, but first I want to get your take on this piece that I ran across.
Yeah.
But Masons and the Making of America by Mitch Horowitz. This is written in 2009. He apparently is editor-in-chief of Torture Penguin and author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. And if you just bear with me, I'll read this to you. Then I want to get your take on it. Because I think we've got to read between the lines here. We have to do when we're talking about Freemasonry and so many things. As millions of readers, not to mention anxious booksellers and publishers, await the launch of Dan Brown's latest novel on September 15th, public interest is riding high on the book's presumed theme, the hidden hand of Freemasonry behind American history. Americans love a good mystery, and Freemasonry, with its penchant for occult symbols and once secretive membership roles that included presidents from George Washington and Franklin Roosevelt, has long provided one. But Freemasonry's real impact on America is richer and more significant than anything that entertainment or speculation would hold. As a radical thought movement that emerged from the Reformation, Freemasonry was the first widespread, well-connected organization to espouse religious toleration and liberty. Principles for the fraternity helped spread through the American colonies. Principles that the fraternity helped spread through the American colonies. It may seem anomalous for such liberal principles to arise from a clandestine brotherhood, but skullduggery was never Masonry's primary aim. In an age of religious conflict in the 17th century, Europe, when an individual caught running afoul of church strictures could suffer persecution or worse, Freemasons clung to the secrecy less out of esoteric drama than political expedience. Freemasons believed in a search for religious truth as it existed in all civilizations, including those of the pre-Christian past, and they drew upon ancient and occult symbols from pentagrams to luminescent eyeballs as codes for ethical development and civic progress. Reactions from church and authorities range from suspicion to hostility. European Masons had good reasons to be discreet. And young American Masons fully took flight, sometimes in unexpected ways. I'm sorry, young America Masonic ideals fully took flight, sometimes in unexpected ways. In Boston in 1775, Freemasonic officials who were part of the British garrison granted local freemen of color the right to affiliate as Masons under the banner of the African Lodge No. 1. The African Lodge later became known as the Prince Hall Masonry, so named for the order's founder, Prince Hall, a freed slave. Hall became the first African-American named a Grand Master. Despite the African Lodge's segregated status, Prince Hall Masonry was a bastion of abolitionism. Its leaders affixed his name to some of the Republic's earliest anti-slavery petitions in 1778 and 1779. As such, African Lodge number represented the first black abolition movement in America. Wherever its heirs of mystery and image of skulls and pyramids and all-seeing eyes, Freemasonry's most radical and even dangerous idea was the encouragement of different faiths within a single nation. Early in the first term, Washington communicated these ideas in a letter to the congregation of a Rhode Island synagogue. It is now no more than that toleration spoken of if it was the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens. In other words, in this new nation, minority religions were just not just guests at the table, but full householders. Washington and other early American Freemasons rejected a European past in which one overarching authority regulated the exchange of ideas. And this outlook is found in one of the greatest symbols associated with Freemasonry, the eye and pyramid of the Great Seal of the United States, familiar today from the back of the dollar bill. The Great Seal's design began on July 4th, 1776, on an order from the Continental Congress under the direction of Benjamin Franklin, another Freemason, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. The Latin maxim that surrounds the unfinished pyramid is "Nuit Cryptis, Novus Order Seclorum," can be roughly, if poetically translated, as "Great Smiles on a New Order of the Ages." Now, let's see here. Today, Freemasonry is a quieter organization, more given to charity events than grand political or religious causes. But historically, its voice and its principles strengthened America's founding commitment to the individual pursuit of meaning. It's not going too far to suggest that Masonry saw America as a republic that protected the spiritual search from majority rule, from foreign meddling, and from sectarian restriction. Beyond our current fascination with symbolism and secrecy, the ideals represent Freemasonry's highest contribution to our national life. So, any comment on that? Sorry for the long...
But... No, I mean, it's just a sickening stream of lies and propaganda. I mean, self-serving. Look, give me an example of where a Freemasonry prevented, some kind of genocide in the last 200 years. I mean, it's been on both sides of almost every genocidal conflict that we've experienced, right? Look at the Civil War, right? Look at Jefferson Davis being surrounded by members of Skull and Bones and then being, released without any conviction. And then look at Sherman's March to the Sea. Sherman's father was one of the premier Masons in the United States, Ulysses S. Grant. And so you've got... when you've had as much genocide as we've had, right, in the last 150 years of Europeans, all I can say is I think it's time for Europeans to try a different political structure.
And from the fires and destructions of the Civil War emerged a new nation, an empire of liberty, right? That's
what I'm saying. Yeah, I mean, that, yeah, it did, except we were...
The crucible of liberty.
You know, your voice is breaking up.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you, but it's not clear. You've got some kind of a feedback loop or something.
Or how about now? Nope,
it's still just really full of static. I'm pretty sure that'll get recorded in that way and people won't be able to understand it.
Did it just start?
It just started all of a sudden. You read the piece and it went fine, and then after that the sound and suddenly went out. You want to try just to reestablish connection and see if it comes back?
Clear? How about now?
Now you're sounding good.
Okay. So now I'm clear?
Yeah, you're loud and clear. Maybe you just got too close to it. I don't know.
Yeah. It's my new microphone. I'm trying to.
Yeah. Well, anyway. So anyway, I was just going to say that, like, look, he's talking. I mean, I don't know what planet the guy's coming from, but it isn't the planet where Freemasons have had political control over so many nations for the last 200 years, during which there has been nothing but impoverishment through central banks that are completely infused with Masonic agents. The political class that always is able to hold the armies in place and reduce population to the greatest degree. I don't think the Irish would have looked upon the Freemasonry of Palmerston and Benson and these guys as being something that was going to lead them into the promised land during the time when they were being, starved to death, maybe as many as 6 million. So I just think that the facts just expose this guy as an absolute liar and propagandist. And he frankly, he would make me angry if he said that in my presence, and I wouldn't permit him to like continue, you know, with the statement after like the fifth or sixth lie. I would interrupt him and just demand that he, present facts to that are in remote relationship to these things that he's saying, because all he's trying to do is just stop the public from going in and trying to get to the bottom of what is behind Freemasonry's destruction of Europe, right? Mm-hmm. That statement is so irrational, so disconnected from history, that it's only, you have to assume that the guy is just as evil as can be, and he's just deliberately creating a smokescreen to confuse people that, hey, you're not getting genocided. Well, we are, frankly, and we don't like it. And we don't like lies about the groups that are involved in it. I don't want to, like, get on some kind of general anti-Semitic bandwagon, but I am somewhat concerned by the fact that he has a Jewish name, because, you know, as we've gone through this show over and over again, we find this weird relationship between elite Jewish families and Masons, you know, as in, for example, the creation of the Nazi Party, which are seemingly inexplicable. But if you start to use the interpretation that the Masons may just be a kind of crypto version of Judaism, then it all starts to make some sense. So anyway, I think that it's actually useful for have those kinds of statements given to the public, so that, you know, it challenges us to, like, try to think clearly about our history. You know, when you hear someone like that talk about all the liberty that's coming forward, and then you look at Palmerston, the head Freemason, he wasn't just, you know, like a lodge brother. I mean, he was the head Freemason of the Orient, and he's gunning down the coolies in China to force them into you know, being addicted to opium, while at the same time he's working to starve the Irish to death, right? I don't see much liberty or emergence of some kind of better nation out of any of this behavior. How about Churchill's firebombing of the civilians? Is this something? Are the Germans getting somehow a better nation out of the Freemasons that both spun Hitler into motion and have created Hitler as the prime minister at the same time, right? So I just think that I would like to say to that individual, I hope that he's simply naive, and I hope that he will do some research and just correct himself in terms of the real history of the last 200 years.
Yeah. Now, yeah, look, I'm talking about American foreign policy, and this is often when people see America as the great Satan, and also it's cultural influence abroad, obviously coming on the heels of the latest U.S. military intervention somewhere, like spreading pornography or abortion, you know, in some of these liberated countries that our military plants its feet. Really, America, the United States, certainly has been a global empire since the end of the Second World War, overtly. Though, you know, you could probably look at the American Empire beginning perhaps 1917 or maybe even the Spanish-American War. But you have these interventions abroad, and particularly the Second World War, you alluded to, or you mentioned at least the firebombing, the Anglo-American bombing raids against Germany and also against Japan in 1945.
The Japanese incidents, where we firebombed and then dropped nuclear weapons on, you know, cities that had 80% population of women and children and no soldiers in them.
Mm-hmm. And called them military targets for the benefit of the American public. And you, of course, you have what happened in Korea in the 1950-1953 when that war was sort of fomented, Dean Acheson saying, we don't really care about Korea. Then all of a sudden, invasion occurs. All of a sudden, we care about Korea. And that creates a pretext for American entry into Asia. This kind of launches the Cold War agenda. But you have, you know, the brutal bombing of North Korea throughout that war. Not I don't think one city was left standing after we were done over there, after the UN was finished over there. It was the UN war. Police action. And of course, Vietnam, of course, that was purely satanic. You have, you know, the we have this thing now, it's called Rolling Thunder, which is when the vets come in and they in honor in Veterans Day, people on motorcycles. But that's named after a vicious bombing campaign that the U.S. Air Force conducted against the people of North Vietnam and also of Cambodia, although, you know, we now know that Nixon didn't begin the illegal bombing Cambodia. He continued it. It began under Johnson, and these things, vicious, wars waged in the false pretenses, because we all know about the Gulf of Tonkin and being a lie. But this, the millions of civilians that have died, not to mention the tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers and hundreds of thousands who were U.S. soldiers who were injured in these wars. And just what's going on today with U.S. intervention abroad, what's going on in Syria, what occurred in Libya a few years ago, these things are invasion of Afghanistan, keeping the world safe for poppy production and distribution, heroin production.
Can I just interject that?
Sure.
I just want to do it because I don't want us to overlook the tragic events in Palestine this week, because they're absolutely, you know, are things which have been created through this satanic force, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we've traced many of our shows. We've traced how Zionism can go right back to the satanic group in Britain, and then when you see the racial policy of the Israelis in relationship to the Palestinians. I mean, this is just a reflection of this philosophy that's consistent everywhere.
Yeah, and of course it's bought and paid for, you know, by the brought to you by the American taxpayer, courtesy of the U.S. government, through the billions of dollars that we subsidize the Israeli government and military to do these things, killing 50 protesters. The overt intervention, that's the low-hanging fruit. Vietnam, that's low-hanging fruit. But what's particularly interesting is this, you know, it's a relatively recent thing, but it really began in the 80s, is the, can you still hear me okay?
Loud and clear, Tim.
Okay, great. Is the use of these NGOs, particularly the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy, and the use of outfits like Freedom House, the use of universities and these things, these NGOs. And many churches, I mentioned this earlier, is going in and spreading democracy or teaching people how to organize and form an opposition. These things are paid for by the intelligence agencies and these foundations, grants, and these things going and destabilize countries. Often it's just to provide support for political opposition to a government or to sort of create destabilizing forces like promoting feminism or so-called LGBTQ rights in traditional societies like Ukraine or something. And what's interesting, this is all the system, I'm referring to the Horowitz article that I quoted, all this talk about freedom and pluralism and diversity, these things, well, in reality, it's really supporting some of these radical groups to go in and completely destabilize society. In many ways, it's been done, in many respects, it's been done domestically, too. We just don't recognize it. But this promotion of these degenerate behavior in these things to kind of destroy these cultures, so then you can bring in the corporations, the Western corporations, whether it's Burger King or Walmart or something, that's what I find, because all this is done in the name of freedom. Or look what they do with like free trade, right? They call it something free trade and it sounds so great, but really you can't have free trade in a world of central banking, monetary manipulation, and also overt coercion with military, these things, and economic sanctions, these things where countries can be cut off from foreign trade overnight because of sanctions and some concern over human rights, some claimed concern over human rights. And of course, a lot of these countries are now forming what appears to be some sort of opposition, like China, Russia, these things, because they realize that if they play by the rules, they can never really break out of their encirclement.
Right. That's exactly right. And sorry, I had someone just come in. I was interested because, you talked about like a lot of elements that actually are related back to the very beginning of our talk, because when they wanted to get rid of the Iranian president and put in Pahlavi, they created unrest, and then they inserted their puppet. If you look at like Gloria Steinem's her first jobs as a CIA spook, it was to go into youth festivals in Europe and create disorder and chaos, right? So chaos is basically, the goal. And of course, it's they have the cover narrative that they're going to try to promote democracy. So they create chaos, and then in the chaos, they insert the puppet, typically, So then that's when they get political control. Another example of this would be like the Hungarian Soviet in 1919, that Bela Kun comes in, and the next thing you know, you've got the satanic Gregor Luchas, giving degenerate sex education to children. They always promise the workers' paradise. There's chaos, and then the chaos, then they're able to manipulate their political control into these things. And so when you look at like Burger King, I really do think it's just the same thing. It's just that, they give America's culture and they talk about democracy and freedom, but the freedom turns out to be eating glyphosate ridden food and watching pornography, and having, like the normal culture that would be sustainable, that would have marriage and tradition and ethnic pride. These things get shattered when this when this curtain that they kind of pull over people's eyes using, concepts like feminism, freedom, it's also reflective in the the theory that cultural Marxism uses, which is just negation, where they just basically are better known as critical theory, but they just, every single aspect of a culture is, publicized as being wrong, is critical. They criticize. And so that just starts to erode the personality of the people inside the culture, right? That's the whole purpose of it. And then once they've got them isolated and shattered enough, then they can transform it. So you always have to wonder, and we should really, you'd think, Tim, have learned the lesson after so many examples of the formula, that, when they promise us the workers' paradise, as soon as the door gets open and their people get in power, it's going to be genocide.
Yeah, and also, but one of the strategies that patterns that you pick up when you're watching this is they work to destabilize a sitting government by promoting so-called democracy and freedom. Yep. And this sometimes it leads to what is called the sort of the liquidation of the state, and then they can quote privatize the assets, the factories, yep, the resources. They really I've heard someone call it it's piratization, not privatization. And you saw this occur in Yugoslavia. They've attempted it in Russia in the 90s. They tried to do it, and this has led to the rise of the oligarchs, which are really assets of New York and London. But they tried to liquidate the Russian state, and they succeeded in liquidating the Soviet Union, and they went in and rushed in and raped the country. And you see that it's probably, you know, it's what they did in Libya overtly. They made off with the gold, the aquifers, and France was one of the natural gas rights. And you see the same strategy occurring, being played out with Israel and Syria, because you know there you have a lot of pipeline politics and also natural gas.
Yeah, look at Haiti. Look at Haiti's another example. Yeah. You know, we're here to help, and then Hillary's brother ends up with the largest gold mine, and the biggest donor to the Clinton Foundation has the permit to handle all the communications, yeah, all the telephones and stuff. Yeah, so they just raped the country.
Yeah, Madeleine Albright cashed in on Yugoslavia. Oversaw the bombing of that country, and what's even occurred like in the Caribbean, Jamaica. I think it's bauxite in Jamaica, which is important with aluminum production or something. Where the CIA has always been involved in supporting criminal gangs there. Pretty much, criminal gangs are supported by the two major political parties over there. But the CIA more or less pays these guys in drugs, and that's how they control the political situation in Jamaica. The story throughout Latin America, you have Guatemala, 1954, when the CIA's they even called it Operation Success or PB Success, but they overthrew the Arbenz government, and painted him red, said he was a communist because he had apparently taken a bunch of fallow land that was controlled by the United Fruit Company under eminent domain, and paid them what they claimed the value was on their tax on their tax forms. And I guess they didn't like that, and so just so happens when you're United Fruit Company and you have representing you Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, you don't have much to worry about. You can call them the goons, head of the State Department, yeah, CIA, respectively, right? And same thing with Chile, 1973. This isn't to say that you have to support everything that these governments are doing. Like you don't have to say that Salvador Allende was the best, had the best policies, but nevertheless, the U.S. should stay the heck out. And it's really not the American taxpayer isn't there to subsidize or insure the interest of Anaconda Steel or ITT or Pepsi Cola Company or something. But you see how these things operate, because why would they be working for Pepsi Cola or Coca Cola companies? Then you find out that Pepsi Cola factory in Vietnam was used to refine heroin.
Right.
See, all these, the airline industry has been used to smuggle drugs, and these things like Pan Am in its day was a huge drug smuggle. There are some rumors today about being spoken about Federal Express and these things. Of course, the airline industry, a lot of airlines have been cutouts or front companies for CIA, like Air America, of course, Southern Air Transport, and that goes way back to the 30s against when we were picking a fight with the Japanese in China. Well, it was largely driven by the opium trade and heroin trade. And that was like Claire Chennault and the Flying Tigers, all these illegal operations that were going, fomenting these wars. Why were we fighting the Japanese in China? Well, it's because America and the British want to control the China trade, and that's largely drugs. And if you look at a lot of American foreign policy, particularly its military operations, interventions, and its intelligence operation overseas, anywhere you see a large-scale military operation or intelligence operation, you find drug route or poppy fields in these things, whether it's Central America, the Golden Triangle, now it's Afghanistan and these things. So you see these patterns, and it's all about bringing the drugs in so you can make a lot of money and also opiate the society.
Yeah, exactly right. And And that really is, good description of like the kind of the weight of evil that is on top of all of us. And, someone was asking me like, well, how do you know like who's in the New World Order? And I said, well, look at the dollar bill. Do you see the expression, that describes the New Order? I said, mm-hmm. Now, do you know and are receiving benefit from the secret society? Because if you aren't, then you're in the old world order. It's pretty much that simple. If you are not in the deal, then you are part of what's going to get crushed. So that means if you aren't receiving direct financial and political benefit from the New World Order, and if you don't understand it, right, and are part of it, then you'd better find a way to resist it, because it is definitely putting you on the chopping block. I was going to, in terms of how the satanic philosophy works, I would point out that they interchange the expression Lucifer and Satan very often. And I think that this is at their higher levels, so to speak, how they talk about it. And I think that, the New World Order group, they can basically interpret words any way they want. They have the power of basically of creating a document and then just interpreting it, right? Like the Constitution, for example. Mm-hmm. But in this case, I think the critical document to understand, and you can see this really when you look at like Aleister Crowley, for example, is the Book of Revelation. Because in the Book of Revelation, at the end of it, you have very clear description of Christ as Lucifer, the bringer of light. What is it? Revelation 22:16. God, I'm getting kind of old here. I can't really remember, but I believe it would be, and there you actually, this is their perspective, that to them, they're bringing a new Messiah, basically. The old one, the Roman Christian Messiah, is not going to be in the New World Order. And if you look at how they interpret the Book of Revelation, it actually talks about a new order when you talk about a new Jerusalem. And they then go on and they say, they often translate the expression as the morning star. It's 22:16, Book of Revelation. It says, "I, Jesus, have sent my angels to give you this testimony for the churches. I am the root and offspring of David and the bright." They translate as morning star, but it's actually just Lucifer. So that's the, I think that's where it comes from, is that these guys have one of the reasons why they're so dangerous is that they see themselves as basically, having an underpinning of religion. I think as they interpret the old world order, the Christian world, that was an entity that they're basically fighting against, right? They basically want to replace it. It's really that simple. But they're not interested in just, converting them. They want to basically extinguish them, I think. So, could be wrong about this, Tim, but that's my honest opinion. I think that, hopefully, as more people become aware of the satanic sort of power that runs our finances, our media, and our foreign policy, that we'll just have more and more research into this. This is just an area that it's tragic in my mind that more people aren't involved in this, particularly Christian scholars, I think, who could actually get in and try to analyze Freemasonry from these aspects. And start seeing that a lot of people that they think are Christian, that are overtly Christian, actually are crypto something. There's some.
Well, yeah, there's been a lot of suspicions regarding some of, the modern popes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think when we talked the other show about how one of the Dulles family, I think it was, I'm not sure if it was his brother or first cousin, but it was a close family relationship of Alan Dulles. Was one that was made a cardinal.
Yeah, Avery Dulles,
after he'd converted to Catholicism. I mean, this is absurd. This just shows that the satanic, to use an expression, force has gained control over the political structure of the Catholic Church. And they're just using it as a toy to keep its population, docile and accepting the cultural destruction and pollution, while they're basically taking the population into oblivion with the techniques, sterilization, through feminism and all of mm-hmm. a lot of other stuff, and through integration.
You saw Katy Perry was invited to the Vatican to discuss transcendental meditation. and she met the Pope.
Finally, the church is turning it around, it's just ridiculous. Katy Perry,
he didn't rebuke her. He didn't hear her confession. She was invited as a guest to give a talk. People say Jesus meant we're sinners. No. She was a guest speaker, and she was given an audience to talk about.
A platform to promote polysexualism and the New World Order. Yeah. She is a local girl. She comes from Santa Barbara, still lives here part of the time. I've never met her, but she gave a show at her high school, and they had photographs of it. I mean, it was 100% satanic. She was dressed up, just in a beyond risque outfit, which was to mimic Christmas candy,
with red
candy cane, right? And she had candy canes all around her. It was at Christmas, but she was representing herself as something that could be consumed.
She's promoting cannibalism. It's strange.
And it was just at Christmas, and it just but also it was just so sexualized. Her lyrics are just basically pornography, and so this was given to us as showing how wonderful our school system is. Look, our alumni who are successful are coming back. I was just head scratching and going, gee, I think some of our alumni are also in the porn business. Are they going to come back and give demonstrations as well for the kids? When we talk about cultural collapse, you're talking about a designed, hypersexualization, the same thing that Gregor Luchas was doing in Hungary in 1919. But a really good way to describe it is just this is Satanism. It's just this is the philosophy of the group that looks to Lucifer. They're going to replace the old world order, the Christian world, with their new one. And the Christians will be, basically put into the categories that Aldous Huxley had, where you're going to have a very controlled, intelligence level that will be created by the state, in the same way that the satanic political forces in America are creating autism. I mean, that is just a real-time expression of Huxley's vision. If you believe, as I do, that there is no chance that they are not aware of the causes of the autism that is just becoming so prevalent in America's birth rates.
It's just genetic, Joe.
Yeah.
Somehow, 20 years ago, genetics changed, I guess.
They just changed over the last 50 years. We took a U-turn. But anyway, the point is you're actually seeing Huxley's vision come to pass. This is what they've always, I think, the eugenics groups.
And you see in popular culture and movies promoting the autism as almost like a superhero capability or power, because, that movie The Accountant, where he's the superhero, because he's autistic. And you have, I think, a TV show with The Good Doctor about some sort of young, a teenager doctor who's autistic, so he's a genius.
Yeah.
As if this is the experience that autistic people usually have.
Yeah, and they have a Call the Midwife. It's a PBS show, series, been on for a few years, and I was watching it, and they have an autistic character now who is irregular and is quite heroic, you know, so you can just see the obvious propaganda to normalize the delta and epsilon categories, right? And of course, they've got the new expression neurologic diversity.
Neurological diversity.
I had someone use in conversation with me last week, so it's not, we're not making this stuff up. And so that will make people feel as bigoted as they did when the government came in to break up the ethnic neighborhoods, when the ethnic neighborhoods were one of the things that created the, you know, value of lives for all of the people inside of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet they were just determined to shatter these things. So, and it was obviously it wasn't done with the idea of trying to help the African American. That's just ludicrous. It was done with the idea of creating easy to control slave groups, which now they can, you know, there's no way to resist things as evil as, you know, the vaccinations that are producing the autism. They're one of the things that are producing it. I think that you have a whole collection of things, you know. But anyway, so it's Tim. I mean, we are really a satanic nation. My opinion, the great Satan is smiling when Old Glory and the Pledge of Allegiance occurs, you know, the public schools and start the day off.
Yes, so it's a unfortunately it's a fair, it's a well earned epitaph, I guess you could say. It's the American people have sat back and sort of treated politics like a or just. Not just so much policy. I don't know the solution is an act of politics, at least at this point. You know, I don't think you can write your congressman
no.
to do any good at this point. But just sort of just awareness, these things that, you know, people are so concerned about the latest, you know, technological gadget to get some convenience or entertainment in these things. Or they're too busy. Just too busy to worry about it.
I'm glad you brought that because you could really see that, you know, that was a brilliant comment, Tim. Because it's when you think of this going on, and then you think of the amount of time the public are just staring at the iPhone, you can see that it isn't just the snooping and the brain control. It's just the power to distract. Mm-hmm. When you're staring into the iPhone, right? How often are you going to be actually looking out and seeing, you know, how the world is being transformed into this, you know, the brave new world?
Yeah, I mean, how often do you look into a car that's driving erratically and they're looking at their cell phone?
Yeah, every time I'm on the road.
You know, and it's just, they can't, I mean, can't break away from for that much for a few minutes that they're on the road or something. They can't, so they'll risk getting in a horrible car accident to see what the latest text is or these things. And
yeah, but Tim, I want to, like, continue on with your idea of, like, well, you obviously we can't, I mean, the congressman is going to be the chief Satanist, typically. You know? I mean, in fact, we should create a whole new vocabulary.
Write, you know, your, like, congressman. Who's your congressman? Denny Hastert? Oh.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in many cases, I think probably even the majority of them, they're not inside the deal. But they are kind of selected for stupidity and docility. You know, you get people who will have an issue, like integration, you know, is like just key to them, you know. And that's, so they have issues which are preposterous relative to the real problem that we're facing.
Yeah, to the real world. Because can you imagine a congressman today trying to articulate opposition to racial integration and maintaining ethnic communities? What he'd be...
Yeah.
At least, I mean, if you're talking about white communities.
How would a congressman even, like, broach the subject with the media?
Well, because they've been denied the grammar to talk about this through, you know, 40, 50 years of psychological warfare. You know, when it wasn't really, you know, it was just, yeah, of course you want to maintain our Irish neighborhoods. We like being Irish, you know, Catholic Americans.
You know, it's what creates value for our lives. This is a free country, isn't it? Why do you want to smash us apart? And then, moreover, it isn't just the affirmative side of how good it is to have ethnic pride and live in an ethnic community. It's why are you breaking it up? Because this is the real, I think, critical thing. It's you're breaking it up to isolate it, fragment us, what, to lead us to a better country? No, to enslave us and then genocide us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's understanding the motivation of the people who are bringing about the destruction of the enclaves, who brought about the destruction of them, and then at the same time trying to, you know, make the affirmative case to Because, you know, there's the propaganda has been so successful that the generation of people who have, you know, European ethnic tradition, right? With, for a phrase, you know, like people have like in these in this era, it'd be like, you know, Irish and German backgrounds or something.
Yeah.
I mean, this group, to talk to them about, you know, a specific value and a benefit to, you know, find people of similar backgrounds, it'd be very difficult because they are oftentimes, you know, so often in the last 100 years, there's been mixing of European ethnicities.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it a little more difficult to, you know, to bring the argument to clarity to people. But the thing I think that will, you know, hopefully focus the young people will be the negative argument, which is, look, this is being done to you know, the integration is in the control of the satanic society. This is not being done because they have a vision of a brave new world that things are going to be terrific. No, it's because they have a the Huxley's vision of what the new world will be, where there'll be intellectual stratification. You know, the people inside the world will be created by the state. There won't be any ethnic, there won't be any family structure producing these people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then they'll be mentally controlled with the iPhone given to the kids, and you know, when they're like 3 minutes old, and then just programmed to basically to be robots. But they won't, this phase won't last long, because you can already see that the robotics are getting developed enough that all of that stuff can be replaced very easily. Mm-hmm. You know? So, you know, you're literally looking at an extinction event. And so, you know, this would conclude the firebombing campaigns of World War II and, you know, the all of the things which are damaging us now, you know, physically and psychologically. It's time to resist. You know, I think that, you know, we go through building out the schematic, and I'm sure that we make a lot of mistakes. I know I do, you know, in the analysis. I know that there'll be, you know, not just picayune, but probably major errors. But the fact is, I think that the general thrust cannot be gainsaid. It's just impossible. This is happening to us. If this is real, we need to find a way to resist. And yeah, we really need, I think, you know, obviously more information has to get out to more people. That's the process that has to happen, first of all. But then beyond that, we've got to find a way not just to make people aware, but to come up with ideas of how to resist. Where are there going to be opportunities for us to basically stay in existence?
Well, yeah, obviously the first step there is developing a language.
Yeah, grammar, they can
articulate these things. Because if you can't articulate them, you can't really think about them. Nor can you defend them or propagate them in a conversation, you know, amongst people. And one thing is just trying to, was one of the points of having the discussion is to create sort of a revisionist interpretation of the past. So we can identify the malevolence and the social engineering and these things, and once you identify those things, then okay, and you know, if you can get people to get the knowledge, the language, it's going to blunt the effectiveness of a lot of this stuff.
I mean,
you're no longer psychologically enslaved to it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well,
and then you can start thinking about it, and that's the first step towards it. From that, the next step beyond that, it's another question. It depends on how, I guess, how violent the system has to get to impose its will. Do they have to rely on, you know, psychological warfare, where your mind is enslaved? And once your mind is enslaved, is it possible to physically enslave humanity? Probably not, which is why they spent so much effort, with mass communication and these things. Entertainment. Like I said, we've talked about this in the past. The whole infrastructure, the whole enterprise of mass communication, entertainment, and these things have been designed to more or less brainwash humanity.
Exactly.
You know. I'm
going to give one example, which is like if you change the description of the Irish Holocaust from the Irish potato famine to the Irish genocide. Right. just that little, like, from a propaganda term to one that describes what happened, right? Then it just helps people think clearly. If the grammar is good, right? If the word, the term that describes the event is accurate, is descriptive. I mean, it wasn't no potato famine. It was a deliberate genocide by the Masons of the Irish Catholics. That's what it was. And mm-hmm. So when people make that switch in grammar, then they can see more easily the satanic hand, the hidden hand of Satan, to use an expression, that is really in back of these things, right? This will help them come up with ways to resist stuff that's happening right now.
Yeah, just same way that you can point out the civil rights movement and the racial integration movements of the 60s were there to actually break up the ethnic neighborhoods, destroy ethnic identity in America. It wasn't there to bring America's persecuted black minority into the mainstream and give them their full rights and privileges as American citizens. That was the excuse. And once you gain that knowledge of how the social engineers and the psychological warfare specialists use that as a pretext to destroy neighborhoods and destroy identity, so these deracinated Irish, Poles could be, sent into suburbia and then, pretty much become sort of the white majority with no real identity to get what you have today now, which is just completely demoralized, no values, no ethnic roots to cling to or to build anything on. And then that changes the whole perception of that era. You know, it loses its progressive, it's sainted, it's sort of the sacred narrative of the civil rights movement. When you start pointing out the fact that, people like Martin Luther King had handlers and it was being manipulated, they were exploiting a difficult situation not to make things better, but ultimately to make things worse. And once you get that understanding of things, and then you're not so terrified of being accused of being sort of retrograde or racist or something, because you're not. I mean, obviously you're not. You just simply have developed a more sophisticated understanding of these things rather than,
It's too bad because you're on such a good roll. Why can you help us again with the whole idea there, going through the civil rights thing? I hate to.
Just once you get this understanding, something like the civil rights movement, integration movement of the 1960s, and these things that sound so good. Everyone, why can't we all get along? Everyone living in peace and harmony and equality and these things. Well, that wasn't really the objective. That was a pretext. If you understand that this was a pretext to go in and destroy these ethnic neighborhoods, which is a strong source of ethnic identity and strength for particular institutions like the Catholic Church, which could provide an opposition to the New World Order, for lack of a better term, because at the parish level. But once you understand that this was a program to deracinate these ethnic groups, send them off in the suburbia where they'll lose their identity, where they can be subjects of the empire and be subjected to all the psychological warfare that that Hollywood or Madison Avenue has to offer them, then it changes the whole understanding of that era. And you're no longer worried about being accused of being a racist or a retrograde for saying, well, why do these neighbors need to be destroyed? Is integration necessarily a good thing? Why should you be forcing people together who have different ethnic and cultural backgrounds? They should have their own areas and communities so they can be allowed to prosper and flourish. But that's the problem. They don't want these ethnic groups, prospering, flourishing on their own terms. They want to be subjects to the empire, and that's why you see these, we point out what's been done abroad, producing and promoting degeneracy in the name of freedom. Same thing occurred here, of course. We call it the sexual revolution, and we call it freedom. And it's just been let, like anything, sexual revolution, just all it did was tell us to give in to our passions and our appetites, like anything. And if you're enslaved to your passion, if you're enslaved to your passions, you're enslaved. I mean, that's And that's what it did. That's to spark the appeal to the libido in these things. So
yeah, resist the self-control that leads to families and extended families and some kind of coherent living experience. You see, that's the thing, is sex was such a great tool for them. Because it was like opium or something. They could claim that, resisting it, the urge in any way, was an illness, mm-hmm. right? And even though the argument is just ridiculous and the benefits of sexual restraint are so obvious that particularly now people have been through it. The pornographic 50-year-old male looking into the future, he knows the truth now. The whole thing was ridiculous. He has no family. He's isolated. He goes to the gym to try to get into shape. But believe me, he's not going to make it in the singles bar anymore. And then, of course, the single mom or, the woman without family who's alone. What kind of life are they having? So, sexual restraint enabled families, which enabled people to have lives that were not miserable. Mm-hmm. And so I think, now, one thing I try to do is, I try to get people who are in a state of misery. I was talking to the result of the satanic influence, talking to this guy, he's younger than me. He's like 58. And, he's been like a playboy throughout his life, right? He was a victim of the sexual propaganda. And he's obviously miserable. He's on meds. He goes to therapy, and he's trying to find a relationship, but he's only attracted to younger women.
well,
yeah, and
well,
and
yeah, young women are more attractive, but if that's the only thing you care about.
And I told him, I said, do you understand that you are completely a slave at this point? And I kind of ran it down to him, and it was odd because even though it was basically showing him that he'd been fooled and that the life he led was completely the influence were weaponized anthropologic structures, and mm-hmm. he was a victim of them, and he ends up now here he is alone, no family, nothing. He's got a lot of money, but he's so miserable. He's been on meds for like 5 or 6 years, and he understood it. He actually got it. Sorry to be long-winded about it, but I said, look, why don't you come forward and give testimony? Because there are a lot of people, males in their 20s, particularly the ones that are have 30 hours of pornography a week or some incredible number. I see these statistics. I don't know how there's enough time for some of the hours of pornography watching that are now becoming medians in certain age groups. But anyway, so it's very popular on the internet. I said, why don't you come forward and talk to these people? I said, you're looking for something to do. Why don't you try to become a mentor? Because you really are the voice of experience. You're someone who can go to a person like, in 26 and say, look, drop the pornography and the hookup sex. Drop the rap music playing in your car as you ride around. You're going to end up like me. If you're lucky, you're going to end up someone like me. Otherwise, you'll just be dead at an early age because you'll probably, end up beaten up in a bar or something, when you're 45s and younger males come in to want to move you away. This life is so useless and miserable, so worthless. Come in and talk to him about that. I said, spend some time. I told him get educated as to what the satanic force had done to him, and then give testimony. And I also think that, it's really because someone like that, he can say, okay, I'm really miserable, horrible. But you look at someone like that, and it's because of the way sex works in our mind, you can say, he's kind of Hugh Hefner, but now he's old. So he had his period, his era. It's like a tit for tat, mm-hmm. at least he had something. The sadder story are the single women, because then you ask, without children particularly, then they in their 50s, because a lot of them were not benefiting in any way. They always really wanted family. They just, the culture was so degenerate that there wasn't an opportunity for real relationships. The men are so degenerate that they just they never really found any that, that they knew they could trust, you know, to be a father,
mm-hmm.
right? So they've been suffering the whole time. But I think even though they should come forward and give testimony against feminism, and the single man, you know, single male should come forward, the you know, the single man in the 50s should come forward and give testimony against the pornographic culture. These things are deliberately designed to lead you into lives that are just ruined and are basically just, you're isolated, so you're easy to enslave, but are existentially miserable, right? And so now, you know, when in the 1970s and 80s, when these philosophies were being given to the baby boomer, we didn't know any better. You know, I was there. I can tell you, we had no clue. But now people do have a clue. And they should come forward and say, look, you've got it. You've got to try to create a family. First thing you got to do, try to create a family. This should be directed more at the males. I think the women, you know, I know they've been, a lot of them have been damaged by feminism. They don't see the you know, the real glory and value of family. But I think that as a, you know, I noticed that the term feminism is declining in use, and more women are not self-identifying with the term any longer. So I think the word is out to women that, you know, really we should be trying to create families. But I still think that pornography is very powerful with young males. And so, you know, this is an area that, you know, if you're out there, you're a single male, you're in your 50s, you're completely worthless, you're not doing anything with your life, you're just staring at yourself in the mirror getting old, you know, go out and give testimony to young people.
Yeah, it's a vicious cycle, because as less men are marriage material or are eligible, yeah, for the responsibility of marriage, women have to go out and get a job and make it on their own, and it's self-justifying. And they don't really see it in those terms, because they'll get on the cycle, you know, where they're working on their career, earning money. Of course, what this does is drives down wages across the board, because you have an inflated workforce. You know, if you have more people looking for the same jobs, this lowers wages, which is part of the plans of the oligarchs for supporting feminism. Is that? But they also they see the idea. I see a lot of I've internalized it that, but not working, they actually see work as empowerment, and really it's enslavement.
Of course,
you know, and they have to drop that pretension and realize that they have to kind of take a step back and let their men lead. But the men have to be, you know, up to the challenge. But the thing is, if they're not encouraging the men, see how the cycle works? You know,
yeah, you know? I think that's absolutely, Tim, that's crystal clear, buddy. Well, yeah, said. I mean, there, I mean, it is. You know?
You didn't actually stay home and bake cookies? Well, yeah. I mean, exactly. I don't know. Yeah, it's nice to have someone baking cookies at home and providing a home.
Let the males actually function in a role that they can do as part of a family.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with that. And as far as women with the task of raising children and keeping home, man, I don't know, but I would bet there are a lot of women now in their 50s and even in their 40s that would give testimony about, you know, this didn't make me happy. I became an executive. I fought for higher salary. I won boardroom battles, you know, whatever. What did it get really, you know? And I mean, life is tough under any circumstances. Not to say that, you know, you have a family, it's all going to be, you know, box of chocolate in the springtime. It's a lot of work and a lot of misery having a family. But I just think that, you know, a billion years of evolution have pretty much got us to the point where we know what is real, you know, and we know what is real satisfaction. And it comes from the process of creation, you know, of making another generation, of having that social structure, of having the kind of intimacy that has profundity. Because, you know, when you know, if you're a parent, you know, if you're a couple with children, you really have a different, you know, meaning to your relationship, because, you know, you really care about the kid, and the fact that both of you have to perform in certain ways in order to, yeah, just get the kid, you know, through every single day. The relationship you have becomes deeper and deeper, you know, and this is really what stems off the existential, kind of meaninglessness of experience. I mean, it is the deepness of relationship that you develop when you have children and, and you have to work together in order to keep the whole thing functioning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, I was watching a TV show and a girl was reading, I guess, Being in Nothingness.
Yeah, there's a cheerful, thing we want kids to be reading.
She's telling this other a mother about it. She's lying down with her 3-year-old daughter, and she's just explaining Being in Nothingness to the mother. The mother goes, I don't know about that. Whoever wrote that book doesn't have a 3-year-old daughter. So,
and that's exactly the right response. And if they want to force your kids to read, feminist literature or ridiculous French existentialisms, then you should just resist it and get your kid out of the school. You know, if you look at it's another subject, but it's just another way that they shatter the minds, of Christian culture is with literature. They promote, you get someone like Sartre, who wrote Being and Nothingness being promoted, and you look at the literature and it's such crap, You wonder, well, why in the world did it ever become popular? Well, it's because people were just told it was magnificent, right? This is mm-hmm. something that you just have to, there. It's an expansion of human experience. No, this again, this is, we have to try to reclaim grammar. Because it's the same thing as referring to someone who wants the value of an ethnic community as racist, someone that doesn't want Being in Nothingness as on the must read list for 16-year-olds. It's because it is a satanic, demoralizing piece of crap,
And look at the era it was written in, right? Post-war France.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was the idea of, after World War I and everything is, bleak and they just want to supposedly create legacy about this period. Nah, that's not. The reason, I don't know, if you think about Sartre, was he someone who was in the deal of the New York, was he a Satanist, to use an expression? I have no idea. I know he was promoted because it was something that his literature demoralized. And made insane the people who read it.
Yeah, it's just like
that's
like,
why
it's like Picasso kind of, or something. You know?
Yeah, exactly. That's why this crap or like Jackson Pollard or something. I mean, this absolute scribbling and the finger painting becomes the great works of art. And then what happens to the public that goes through this? Well, they just become basically crazy and brain dead. And in back of all this is the smiling Satan.
Yes, the great deceiver.
Yeah, the great deceiver is that, and we've just been fooled. See, so to like resist. I think it's a good point, Tim. Is that one thing that everyone can do is try to reclaim grammar. No more Irish potato famine, Irish genocide. No more modern art. Vomit. On canvas. I mean, just reclaim the honest descriptions of what you're experiencing and don't let them use these expressions unchallenged. And, this is probably a pretty good thing because it's really just the intimidation. It's not that our brains have been rewired so we're so, autotomic that we can't see what's real. It's just that the language itself, the words that go through our mind have been designed to keep us intimidated. So we feel slightly self-conscious, even talking about the value, for example, of an ethnic community or of a family, we're a little nervous about talking about, now it's getting to the point even a heterosexual, the advantages of heterosexuality in a family structure is basically a kind of racism against the transgender, polysexual, GBTL crowd.
Mm-hmm.
So that grammar is being slowly taken away from us. And, you know, people just have to stand up and use the right expression, because when we do that, then we keep these things normalized enough so that they can be discussed. And that's what enables the intimidation to be held in check. We've really got to reverse the intimidation. I mean, you know, sort of like the moon landing. I don't know. I just got a lot of people, you know, commenting on, they thought it was a great discussion because we basically just made them laugh. You know, it was funny. Mm. And I think the reason, you know, because I know there are lots and lots of people who have so much technical debunking of the thing, certainly a lot better than I do. But if you can get people to see that it's funny, right, then that may be a little hasn't the advantage of ending the spell of intimidation.
Yeah, intimidation is a big thing. I was reading an article about Robert Mapplethorpe. There was a strategy. The obscenity case was started in Cincinnati, Ohio. And the reason why, Cincinnati is a conservative town, largely Catholic. And they put on, the local art museum put on a show of his photography, and it violated local obscenity laws. And a case was brought up, was started, kind of like one of these fomented legal cases to establish a precedent. And they had a whole trial about whether or not it violated obscenity laws. And the question was whether it was art or not. And it was clearly obscene.
That was Christ in the urine? Was that?
Yeah, Christ in the urine. Yeah. That was weird. Thumbing people up a man's,
yeah, just completely insane, yeah. Vomited, satanic nonsense. Yeah,
and go ahead. They need experts to testify that it's art. Now, if you need an expert to tell you that something's art, something's beautiful, then it clearly is not. I'm sorry. You don't need to look at the Sistine Chapel and go, is that art? I mean, of course, yeah, it's going to be art. You can look at the Pieta and go, yeah, that's art. Right? It's not going to be, it's going to be, but only, you know, this is also photography. And, they had an expert go, an expert in quotes, of course, gives testimony that it is art. Therefore, that it's permissible. It has some redeeming quality because it's art. And the juror, they asked the juror who decided in favor of the art exhibition, said, "Well, I didn't think it was art. I wouldn't know better because I'm not an expert. The expert told me it was art, so we ruled that it was art."
that's the thing. And then that person is already a victim of intimidation.
Yeah,
he went in basically incapable of being, you know, an honest juror because there was intimidation and he couldn't think clearly about the situation, you know? So it's, the intimidation basically enables them to function in what purports to be a democracy, right? Mm-hmm. Which of course we know it's not, but it purports to be and can operate as such. In other words, people will still show up at the polls and vote things.
Yeah,
because we are intimidated to the extent that we will permit the Republican Party and the Democratic Party to basically completely dominate the political landscape, and we will not, you know, organize ourselves through the grammar that we have to be able to resist, you know, mm-hmm. a new party or basically overthrow them, you know.
So, well, Joe, I think we covered it.
Oh, the great Satan. I don't know if he's smiling up there now, but hopefully, we can, it's a force that can be defeated. And it starts with us and with, just talking about this stuff.
Great. Okay, Joe.
All right, brother.